Do you think a gun is a fitting commemorative for your father, Patrick Wayne?
I think this gun happens to be a perfectly appropriate commemorative for my dad. This particular commemorative is a single-action Army Colt, and the gun was developed and designed and produced some 110 years ago. And this particular model represents that model. So it's a fairly antique gun starting off. It was a gun that some people claim won the West, and it certainly is tied very much with our American heritage, our folklore. And John Wayne certainly became the symbol of the American West, working in several Western motion pictures, and his whole personality on the screen and off the screen represented the ideals of what the American cowboy stood for. So I think it's a fitting tribute, sure.
Michael Wayne, do you want to describe the gun?
Yeah, it's a single-action Army. It has a 4.5-inch barrel. It's got a deep blue finish, and it's selectively gold-plated. I'm going to turn this around here if I can.
Okay. It's turning around the, was it oak box that it comes in?
Yeah, it's an oak presentation box with a kind of a burgundy leather lining. It's got a gold eagle on the barrel, which I said is a 4.5-inch barrel, and that's the gun that my father used in about 100 of those Westerns that he made. It's got a likeness of him, a picture of him done in gold on the cylinder, and it's from one of his favorite photos of himself from the film The Alamo. It's also the same one that the U.S. Mint used when they... when they made the gold medal. He got a special congressional gold medal. Family's kind of proud of that because only 83 Americans for the last 200 years have received one. So anyway, that picture's on there. And on the other side, it's of the cylinder, there's a man on a horse, which is, you know, very typical of a cowboy. And it's got the ivory grips, which are the same as on the gun that he used in, you know, all those films.
How did this gun come to be?
Michael, why don't you feel that? He worked with the Colt people.
Yeah.
Directly.
Actually, Colt approached us and said, we would really like to do a John Wayne commemorative. And we thought it was a very, very good idea. We had done a Winchester commemorative, which is, a long gun rifle. And that was also characteristic of him in several of the films, and this just seemed kind of a natural. As Patrick said, people that that collect guns are interested in history and tradition, and then the mechanical excellence and the design and the quality of the piece. And this is really a quality piece and a real collector's item. They're only making 3,100 of these, incidentally. So that's for the whole world, and that isn't an awful lot of pistols.
Did John Wayne own a lot of guns?
He had a pretty good collection of guns, but he had a lot of them. I guess it wouldn't be fair to call it a collection since he wasn't a real collector of guns. But he had several of them, and a lot of them from he got from when he was working, and a lot he got from friends that would give him things. And he was kind of superstitious about receiving things, and so he kept everything. He didn't get rid of anything that he had, and so he had a fairly extensive collection of guns, which are now on display, or they have been given to the Cowboy Hall of Fame in Oklahoma, isn't that right?
Yeah, he donated them before he died. He donated all of his guns and all of his artwork to the Cowboy Hall in Oklahoma City.
Did he ever use the guns? Did he hunt with them? Or?
Well, I think that he was a bird shooter with shotguns, but he was not really a deer hunter or anything like that.
What did he teach you about guns when you were growing up?
Well, a healthy respect for them. As I said, he had guns around him all the time, and so there was something to be respected, understood, and I think we all knew what it was about and treated them with a great deal of respect.
This is Michael. He taught me that every gun was loaded.
Were there usually loaded guns around the house?
No, but in order to get that respect that Patrick was talking about, he said every gun is loaded, so we were not allowed to touch them, pick them up, or do anything else. And then you get you kind of ignore them after a while, or you become accustomed to them.
I remember when I was about 10 years old doing just what he said we weren't supposed to do. I picked up one of these guns, and I had my younger sister in the room with me. And about a year after that, we were in Ireland, and he was making a film over there. We were all over there visiting. We used to eat dinner at a big table with all of the members of the cast and the director. And he chose that time to bring up the fact that I had touched his gun. He said, "Why did you pick that gun up?" And it caught me completely off guard. And it was very embarrassing, and but also very effective. And I've never forgotten that. And it was one of the ways that he got his point across.
And you never picked up any more guns.
Exactly.
What kind of talks, if any, did you have with him before he died about how his image should be used or his name used in the merchandising of products?
Well, he pretty much talked to Michael about that.
Yeah, I actually, before he died, it went way, way back. I said, you know, you ought to write a book or something, because I said, you're a fairly famous guy, and people are going to write books about you, and they're going to say what they want about you. And I said, I think it would be good if you'd write a book about yourself, an autobiography. And He didn't want to, and I said, look, somebody else is going to do it. I said, how would you like me writing a book about you? He said, oh, God, I'd hate that. So I said, you better do it. And he said, okay. So we got a good writer named Wayne Warga, who is head of the calendar section of the Los Angeles Times. And we made an arrangement where he would write a book. He and my father would write a book together. Well, what happened was my father really wasn't interested, and he never got together with Wayne and finally said to me, hey, why don't you do it 10 years after I'm dead? So he really wasn't too interested in, let's say, his image after he died. He did say one thing to me. He said, Michael, if anything is done, he said, I want you to supervise it completely. I want you to have 100% control of it. And I said, but what if I get hit by a truck or I die? And then he says, well, then I don't want anybody to do anything. Because during his life, I was more protective of him than he was. You know, let's say I was more careful about things than he was. He had an instinctive good idea about what he should do and what he shouldn't do, or of right and wrong or good and evil. And he just always seemed to do the right thing. Now, you know, a lot of people didn't agree with him, but I think most people respected him, and he was a very honest, outspoken kind of guy.
There are bullets that can be used in this gun, right?
Well, yeah. This is, as I say, it's a kind of an antique-type weapon, and it is a commemorative. And if anybody shot it, it would be worth about half as much. But as you know, Ralph Nader and his group insist that if a product is made and for a specific purpose, that it actually do that specific purpose. So before these things are all finished off with the gold and everything else, they are fired there. But the chances are they will never, ever be fired, and a lot of them will never be taken out of the original boxes.
You must have asked yourself, though, what it would mean if somebody bought this gun and instead of keeping it in their living room on display and waiting till it became a collector's item, used it and ended up killing someone with it.
Well, I think it's kind of remote. The if somebody was going to buy a gun and kill somebody with it, they wouldn't select this. You know, I think that there are probably, well, I know that there are much more, many more less expensive guns that would probably do a better killing job if that were somebody's purpose. Now, if it's I don't know. I guess that a child could pick up a gun, and then maybe I don't know how they could get the bullets for it, because you know, these aren't. It isn't exactly a modern bullet. But if they could come across a bullet and then get it in and fire it, I think it's a very remote possibility. But yeah. I suppose it could happen. Yeah. But then if you gave them a brick and it fell on one of their heads, I mean, you know, the same thing could happen too.
Yeah. A lot of killers aren't like especially logical to people who aren't murderers themselves. Do you think it would be possible that someone would say, oh, neat, you know, a real cowboy model, just just what I wanted and intentionally seek something like that out?
Oh, no, no. I think that this is not the gun you would select to go commit a crime or rob a bank or anything else. It's, I think you get something a little bit different.
How is it being marketed?
Well, this is a prototype that that we have here today, and it's being announced at this NRA convention, and I believe they're going to start delivery to their regular gun distributors and dealers sometime in May, towards the end of May. They hope to hit the market by then, and it'll be sold just like they would the Colt people normally sell their guns.
Yeah, they have other commemoratives that they have made, and it'll be done through their distributor and dealer chains.
If you're just joining us, Patrick Wayne and Michael Wayne are my guests, and they're here for the, what is it? It's not exactly an opening. What would you call it? The
announcement.
Announcement, yes, of a commemorative gun made with the likeness of their father, John Wayne, on it. Would you compare for us a little bit about what he was like on screen and off screen as a person?
My feeling is that he was very much the same person on and off screen. I think the qualities that he exhibited in his characters on the screen were very much the things that he believed in and lived by. And I think he was very consistent in his life too. He believed in strong values of friendship, reliability, trustworthiness, dependability, honesty. And lived by these things, and expected that of his friends, and gave it back to his friends
and his sons.
You know, just flipping through my memories of his films, and I haven't seen all of them. It seems like in most of the films, he's kind of a wanderer. You know, just dropping in on different cities.
But at
the end of the film, he settles down. Usually, at the end of the film, he frequently meets a woman who he falls in love with, she falls in love with him, and at the end of the film, they're riding off together to start a family, but we frequently never get to see what that family is like or what he is like as a father in the movies. How much of when he, in real life, was he the wanderer part, and how much was the part afterwards which we didn't get to see in which he settles down and becomes the father in the family?
Well, I think that when you say he's a wanderer, I think that he's independent and self-reliant, and that characterized him. I don't think that Patrick Meany was exactly on screen the same as the way that he was off screen, because in films like Red River, which I don't know if you know this, but it was Mutiny on the Bounty, and he played Captain Blythe, and Montgomery Clift played Mr. Christian. Now he was the bad guy in that. You know, he was really a tough, ruthless guy, and he played it with a lot of conviction. And because he was so believable, he actually got sympathy from the audience. He was able to project himself. He was able to project his own, let's say, honesty, integrity. He was also able to project evil qualities with honesty when he played these roles of being what we call heavy in films, or the bad guy. That doesn't answer your question, does
no,
it?
No, if it's too personal,
No.
I
just want to make a comment on that, and the fact that the brand of the Red River is on this pistol, and it was, to me, a very interesting role for him, because he was, in fact, the bad guy, and yet he came off as almost heroic.
Yeah. It's just so ironic to me, because I know the values that he stands for, and not so much of that has to do with family and good upbringing, but on the other hand, the values of the cowboy is the man loner who's on the road, so to speak, on the trail or whatever all the time, and is independent and has no attachments, and there's no time for attachments in their life.
I think that since let's say the cowboy, and let's say the cowboy is the center of American folklore or the character, the man of American folklore. I think that he had these qualities that Patrick talked about. I mean, courage and self-reliance and independence and all of that. And I think that he had them both, on a line shack in Montana all alone in the middle of a blizzard, as well as in the middle of New York City. I mean, those type of guys carry their principles with them and don't give them up no matter where they are. And I think that characterizes my father too. Whether he was out on the road or on location making a film, or whether he was at home with us, I think that that he possessed and let's say exemplified or stuck with these principles. I think he was much tougher on himself than he was on anybody else.
There is a parallel in there in what you're saying, in the fact that he was away on location, because when you make Western movies, you have to go away to some remote place to do it. So when we were growing up, he was away working a lot. We had an opportunity, though, during the summers and stuff to travel with him and spend time with him. And for me, that was that was a terrific experience, because it was away from a home situation. It was kind of a special place to be and a privileged place to be. And so, I worked in a lot of films with him growing up, and that was a terrific experience. My brother's experience is a little different, because I worked as an actor with him, and he was working as a producer with him. So it was a little bit different as it got
older.
Let's
put it this way. My father was much kinder to actors than he was to producers.
Well, Patrick, you were in Red River, right?
No, I wasn't in Red River. The first film I did was...
No, I didn't mean Red River.
Rio Grande was the first film, yeah,
right.
And several after that, several Westerns specifically. In fact, a couple that my brother produced, McClintock, The Alamo, Big Jake, were a couple of the Westerns. And I was in another Western called The Searchers with him, which was also a classic film directed by John Ford.
You were like 11 when you were in Rio Grande, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did it seem like a really big deal to you as a kid of 11 to have your image on the large screen when you went to the movies?
Actually, they said, "Do you want to work in the film?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." And they said, "Well, we'll give you $10." I said, "Sure." I was thinking about the candy I could buy with the $10 more than, the results of what the work was going to be. It wasn't like work. It was everything tied into it for me was the experience of being on location. And it also, it sort of made me independent and separated me from the family thing and let me be out sort of on my own. Even though I was with my father, he was working and I was getting into trouble and doing things like that. And because right after that, I went and did a film in New York at West Point. And I was really on my own there. I was about 14 years old, and my father wasn't in the film, so I didn't really have a direct parent watching over me or something like that. So,
but you weren't impressed, though, with the hugeness of the image of yourself and your father. You were really used to it, and it didn't seem like a big deal.
Yeah, no. When I saw it, I was a little bit. I felt a lot of things actually when I saw it. It was too big and too weird. It was very strange, and it was kind of scared me a little bit actually.
How much was your father to you a movie star? Did you see him with the eyes of everybody else, to whom he was this untouchable hero, like most movie stars are movie heroes, or was he someone who was very real and who was blown up through movies?
I'll give you my, because I think probably Patrick and I have different opinions of the thing. I think my father had something. I don't know whether you call it charisma or what. But if he walked into the room, you knew somebody walked into the room. You may not be able to recognize him, or you may never have seen one of his films. But when he walked in, you knew somebody walked in. He had the kind of drive, and I don't mean ambition, because I think ambition has a kind of a negative aspect, but he had the kind of drive that I think that if he became a lawyer, he'd have been the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or, if he was in the Navy, which incidentally he wanted to do, he wanted to go to Annapolis, he would have become the Admiral and maybe the head of the Chief Joints of Staff. I mean, he had that kind of drive, and he worked. He was a consumptive worker, and he used to say, I've been lucky in my life. He said, I spell it H-A-R-D-W-O-R-K. He worked for every single thing that he got. I think that as far as I was concerned, I was aware that he was something special, even though he was my father. I could see it in other people. And that's the way I became aware of it. When he would come in the room and people that I thought were very important and everything else would seem to disappear or melt into the corner. He had an energy and a personality and seemed to have an aura around him that was like a magnet and would attract people, and it was something pleasant that they liked.
How did you experience it, Patrick?
Yeah, that pretty much expresses it for me, too. I know even in bigger situations, he couldn't walk down a street without being besieged by a mob. It was incredible. And So I suppose I saw that too. I also appreciated the way he handled it, and I learned a lot from that too, because, you know, sometimes I'd look at this and I think, oh my God, you know, give me a break, or, you know, doesn't it drive you crazy? Because people do different things. When they're in a situation like that, they react differently and probably not the way they are normally. They get embarrassed and confused, and so they all quite often say things they don't mean to because they're embarrassed. And some people get aggressive and hostile, and you know, I'd see this stuff and it would really irritate me. And he'd say, no, he said, you know, and he explained this to me that, you know, that isn't the way they are, and they're gonna feel worse about it later than anything I could say. So, you know, he had an ability to handle all of that stuff without getting upset. And that was a good lesson for me too, because, you know, I tried to apply the same thing to my life, but he was incredible that way.
Yeah, I think that as far as, he had no privacy, I think Patrick is saying, and yet when he was with people, when he would, you know, walk down the street and let's say he would create a riot or a mob, he would stop and sign every single autograph and talk to all the people. And if they wanted to take pictures, he would take pictures of them, or he'd hand me the camera and make me take pictures with both of them together. And, you know, it did become annoying for me, and they weren't even interested in me. And he said, Michael, these people are the people that pay for my food. And he said, the minute they stop asking me for this, I'm in trouble, and I owe my success to them. And so I belong to them. And he really felt that. And so he lived his life and he accordingly.
Michael Wynn and Patrick Wynn are my guests, if you're just joining us. What did he teach you about what it meant to be a man in America?
Well, I think what we talked about earlier in the show about his values, belief in other people, his, you know, his trustworthiness, honesty. Honesty, I think, was a big one for him, and reliability and dependability. He, if he was a friend to somebody, he stuck by them, and in a lot of cases, this got him in trouble. He, you know, every business deal that he got into wasn't always successful, but if he was a friend to somebody, and he usually was a friend to somebody that he got into business with, why, he stuck with them right to the end. And so in a sense, I guess you could say it was a kind of classic tragedy. The things that were great about him were also the things that got him into trouble. But pretty clear values in that. And, you know, he was right out there. He had things that he believed in, and he had the courage to stand up and tell you about it.
I guess I was wondering what he taught you a man was like and a woman was like. Or should be like, with the ideal.
He didn't have to explain that to Patrick.
No, but he didn't really, none of this that I'm talking about, and maybe my brother had a different experience of it, but he didn't really sit down and talk about things explicitly. What I learned about him was just being around him and watching him. And that was just his example. I mean, that's what he wasn't a person that said one thing and lived another way. He just lived a certain way, and that's what we're talking about. I'm not, because he didn't really preach. He wasn't a person to preach. If I did something wrong or anything, I heard about it, or we did, you know. But he didn't tell us how to behave or what was right and wrong in that sense. We were left pretty much on our own, and I think that just gave us a chance to observe what was happening, and that's what I'm talking about. So there wasn't any real lesson for me. Maybe, I don't know, Michael has.
No, I think that he let us do what we wanted to do whenever we wanted to do it. And unless we made a mistake, we never heard anything. I mentioned before that my father was interested in the Navy. When he was in high school, he was an all-star athlete, and he was a real achiever in terms of grades, and he was a student body president and all of that. He was very involved in school activities, you know, on the debating team, the Shakespeare Society, and all of that. And he wanted to go to Annapolis more than anything. He wanted to have a career in the Navy. And in those days, like today, I think each senator could appoint two people. So he took the test, and he came in third, which was the alternate. In other words, there were two guys ahead of them, and both of them elected to go to Annapolis. And I remember him telling me that. He says, and a pimply-faced kid like Michael here, he said, you know, beat me out to go to Annapolis. So when I was graduating from high school and going to college— He said to me, at that time, Richard Nixon was a senator, was a friend of his, and I personally had actually done work for Richard Nixon to help him get elected. So I was kind of, you know, I knew him, and I was, I had a good shot at getting that appointment because a senator can appoint somebody. And he said, oh, well, Michael, now, you know, you can get an appointment to go to Annapolis. And I said, well, I don't want to go to Annapolis. And he said, well, gee, I always wanted to, you know, be in the Navy and have a naval career. It's a terrific thing. And I said, but I'm not interested in it. So he said, okay. You know, so it wasn't anything. He let me know how he felt, but then he wasn't insistent. He just, he wanted to know that that opportunity was there for me if I wanted it, that he didn't have it, and that he would have given anything for it, but it still didn't convince me to want a career in the Navy.
Getting back again, though, to the difference between the values that people have in Westerns and the values your father typified in Westerns and the values that he had off the screen. In Westerns, there's frequently like one woman who is really brave and strong and rides alongside the men in the film and can shoot a gun and can really handle herself in tough situations. Most of the women in the films, though, stay at home, don't ride that well, don't know how to handle a gun, and it's the job of the men to protect them and to look out for them because they can't do it themselves. Did that sense of male-female relationships, which of those senses applied for him off-screen?
I know at Harvard a few years ago, he was back there being interviewed, and they asked him the question about women and the new women in society's consciousness and women's liberation and everything. And he said, I think a woman can do anything she wants in life as long as she has my dinner on the table at 6 o'clock. So I don't know if that answers your question about how he felt about women, but
no. Let me say I think I have a better viewpoint of how he felt about women. He put women on a pedestal, and he had a classic, and if you will, Western kind of point of view about women. He felt that a man had a certain responsibility, and maybe it's the classic hunter, you know, provider, and that the women were the nesters and took care of the home. And I think that was true in life and may have gotten him into some trouble because, as you know, he was married three different times, or as you may not know, I don't know. But he put women on pedestals and felt that he had much, I would say, a great respect for women and maybe expected more of them than he would of a man, and maybe was disappointed sometimes.
Is that anything you would ever talk about with him, or is that a subject that you would not talk about?
Well, when I was married before, and before I got married, I went to see him, and before I said anything to him, he said, "Don't talk to me about this. I've been married three times." It wasn't anything he really discussed, I guess. He just, again, he lived his life, and you said, you know, he just said, look at my life, and that's, you know, basically where he felt. But I think, what Michael says is accurate, and I think it's, you know, there's like a confusion thing set up in there for him.
I'm not sure which sons these were and if you're involved with this or not, but I know one of the films that he shot was near the sites of atomic testing in Nevada. And one or two of his sons, and again, I'm not sure if you're involved with this, were suing. I read this in a magazine about a year ago.
No, that's not true. It's me. I was in the film. It was a film called The Conquerors, and he played Genghis Khan. It was not one of his most celebrated films, but it was an interesting film when you have John Wayne playing Genghis Khan, you know. Anyway, it was filmed in an area in Utah. Specifically Snow Valley, which is a kind of a catch basin, and the winds, I guess, blow across the desert there and kind of settle in this Snow Valley area. It's far from Snow Valley. I mean, it's white, it's sand, and it's hot. And they filmed a lot of the battle scenes there, and, of course, there were horses and all sorts of equipment stirring up all of this dust and everything. And what happened was that it seemed to me an unusually high incidence of cancer hit the cast and the crew on that film. I think almost half of the 200 people involved in the film got cancer, and a high percentage of them died. And I don't remember what it was. We were never suing the government, and that was an erroneous report. What I wanted to do, and some of the other people involved was to bring this to the attention of the government and the proper agencies through the media, so that if there was any future atomic testing or anything like that, they'd just be more careful, that's all, and that they would have a better coordination between the various departments. I think that's basically the problem when you have the military and you have private industry and you have government bureaucracy involved. There's sometimes a lack of communication and information. And I think that's what happened there, and that there were some unsafe things that happened. And I don't know. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. It's just that the statistics looked a little more than coincidental that all these people should catch cancer.
At the time of the movie, were you aware of the proximity of the movie set to the atomic test sites?
No, not at all. And it wasn't. It wasn't that it was so close. It was that the prevailing winds, took all of this, atomic particles down into this particular area. I remember that one doctor was quoted as saying, "Oh my God!" He said, "I don't mind losing a few goats, but," he says, "I hope I haven't killed John Wayne." And that was the reaction of one of them. You know.
Do you remember at the time that uranium was the big thing? Mining uranium was, and everybody had their Geiger counters, and they were all out looking for this stuff.
We had one. Patrick and I had one. We were around with the Geiger counters, and it was ticking away.
Yeah, we heard
like
all
dummies.
This
we were running all around. You know,
we were thinking we're going to be millionaires.
And it was really just radiation from.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, you know, yeah.
Well, I remember in westerns of that period, all the people heading west were always looking for uranium with Geiger counters too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, when your father was dying, I think he was frequently compared to a cowboy in the way he fought cancer, since he was able to really keep it at bay for a pretty long time. I guess he went into remission. Did you feel that way about him, that he was like really
indestructible? I felt he was indestructible, and I honestly didn't believe anything was ever going to happen to him. Well, he had cancer the first time he had a lung removed in 1964, and The next time he had cancer, it was totally different. I mean, it wasn't associated with that one, so it wasn't like it was in remission from that. He actually beat it. He actually licked cancer, I feel, when he beat that one. He was always called a very courageous person, and I think at that point in his life, he really exemplified the true courage that he had. I mean, that to me was the living proof of it. He was so strong. He never complained, and he was in a great deal of pain. And I always had the feeling I spent every day with him, and I always had the feeling that he was going to turn this thing around.
Yeah.
I had more respect for him those few weeks, or I got more respect for him dying than I did living, and I had a great deal of respect for him when he was living. As Patrick said, he was strong, he was courageous, he kept a sense of humor about everything, and really, he never gave up hope, at least to us. Now, I don't know how he felt inside, unless he was hiding something, and he wasn't that kind of guy. But I remember just a couple of days before he died, he had to get up, and it was a great deal of trouble to get up and walk down the hall. And he says, "I got to get up." And he gave me a hand, and I said, "Well, maybe you ought to just rest there." I said, it's a lot of trouble for you to get up and walk down the hall. He says, "If I don't get up out of this bed," he says, "I'll end up being an invalid." So he really never gave up. You know, he really never gave up trying to live.
You're both in the film and television industry. What are some of the pros and cons of being a second-generation person in the entertainment industry?
Well, for me, it's just been a tremendous help, to be honest with you. I mean, from a very early age, I was around the industry that I chose to work in. I had an opportunity to meet the people and the powers that be that hire me. And it's just a very big privilege and unusual situation to be in that way. There have been, a lot of people just don't have an opportunity like that. And I think to the extent that you take advantage of that is, you know, is where all of the strength comes or the advantages come. It basically is a big advantage. And any disadvantage associated with it, to me, is just created inside the individual themselves.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, yeah, I think that the advantages far outweigh the disadvantages. I had an opportunity to produce a major John Wayne film at 25 years old. And if I wasn't John Wayne's son, I wouldn't have been there. I'd been selling insurance someplace. And I feel like Patrick does. An opportunity is never missed. If you don't take it, somebody else will. So, I guess I believe in nepotism. I don't know, because I took advantage of every opportunity I had.
Do you have any favorites of his films?
Oh, I do, yeah. I like not any one, I wouldn't say, but I liked Red River. I like The Searchers. I like the character he played in The Searchers. I like The Quiet Man. Pretty much the whole film, I guess. It was partly the whole film and the experience of being there, I guess, when he made it. I don't know, there's five or six of them for me.
Michael?
Yeah, I like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon. I thought he was terrific in that. It was similar to Red River in that he played a man much older than his years. I felt he should have been nominated for that. He was nominated for Sands of Iwo Jima, and of course he won it for True Grit. I thought that his performances in The Shootist and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon were far better.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry.
Thank you very much for having us.